Great. Welcome back for another episode of Subscription Radio. I'm your host, DJ Fish, a.k.a. Ben Fisher, a.k.a. CEO of Rodeo. With me, I have a special guest and friend, Mike Dubow, who's a partner at Greylock. But before that, he was the VP of Growth, Head of Growth of Stitch Fix. And so, you know, what's interesting about Mike, and part of the reason, you know, I've been trying to get Mike on our show for a while, is early on, I would say like around the Carthook days or just post-Carthook, Mike and I were talking about sales enablement around e-commerce, things, trends that were happening around D2C. And now that he's an investor, he thinks a lot about e-commerce and enablement and marketplaces, and is very familiar with like the Shopify ecosystem as well as like Headless, which I know you've made some bets in. So, you know, and I'd say like in terms of just like some of the highlights, did you lead Postscript's round? I know that's one of your earlier investments. Builder and Postscript are the two that really stand out to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy to do. And great to chat. Always enjoy riffing with you, Ben, or I guess DJ Fish here. And yeah, I'm happy to chat about any of that stuff. You know, to take a step back, most of my background actually prior to Greylock was kind of leading growth and user acquisition functions, different kind of consumer e-commerce companies. Stitch Fix was the most recent one, which was more kind of like running the marketing budget, kind of doing at-scale performance marketing stuff. And prior to that was kind of doing more kind of product and community-oriented growth, a company called Tilt and some other stuff before that. But yeah, as you noted, like at Greylock, where I've been the last 3.5 years, have mainly been investing around kind of commerce and marketplace, I guess, network businesses. So within commerce, you know, I kind of split it into like infrastructure enablement for D2C commerce, as well as like B2B commerce, which is kind of separate. So like B2B mm-hmm. commerce, B2B marketplaces, including like, yeah, you know, there's some examples around food and kind of grocery, Pepper and Vori. There's another one that's kind of like the fair for Latin America called Inventa. Another one, raw materials, called Novi. So that's probably out of scope for today, but around kind of like the D2C stuff. Yeah, Postscript, we led the Series B there. So I sit on the board there, as well as mm-hmm. Builder. We led the seed and then the Series A, which is kind of extends beyond commerce, kind of a no code headless page builder, mm-hmm. as well as kind of a couple other ones, Tido, which is around kind of like analytics, another one called Treat. So yeah, that's kind of where I've been focused more recently at Greylock.
Got it. And I'm curious, I think, so you were at Stitch Fix, you left about 3.5 years ago. Was that right?
That's right.
I'm curious, one of the observations I'd be curious is, how has, we'll call it D2C and even growth, changed from even the last 3 years? And granted, like that type of business is different than like a shelf stable CPG product.
Yeah.
But just talking back and even thinking back to your experience and some of the different plateaus that you guys were dealing with around growth at Stitch Fix, were there certain moments and certain sort of like peaks and valleys that stand out to you that you either see with brands that you're talking to today? And in what ways have the dynamics completely changed because of maybe increased competition or more VC or whatnot? So I feel like Stitch Fix was fairly early in the game.
Yeah. And it's interesting. Like Stitch Fix was actually, you know, I think of Stitch Fix less as a brand and more of kind of a new channel, mm-hmm. new distribution channel for kind of like other merchants and really a new way of shopping. So, but yeah, we did kind of come up in kind of the earlier days of kind of when, you know, D2C commerce was becoming a thing. So we kind of get grouped into that. And I do think, so there's kind of two different topics here. It's how has D2C evolved and how has the function of growth evolved? I think, you know, on the growth piece, it's funny because even growth is a very loaded like term. And I think that the head of growth role, the VP growth role, is very different depending on context. So actually like a lot of mm-hmm. my friends from Reforge, which is really a great program for like training growth people, and, you know, tend to focus more on kind of the product and kind of principle, product oriented principles around kind of growth versus I think in D2C and e-commerce, you know, really the main levers that you have are marketing channels. And so it tends to be more of a marketing function. You know, I've kind of lived both and I feel like there's a set of common principles that kind of like underpin both. But I feel like for most of the time, when we talk about growth in e-commerce, it's performance marketing, which by the way, is part of the problem here right. in that like for a lot of these brands, you actually don't have too many mechanisms to grow other than kind of spending money on marketing, And, you know, as we've learned, like the laws of gravity tend to kick in with scale, acquisition becomes more expensive over time. And so it's just, you know, these things tend to not compound, or they tend to, it's harder to kind of grow them, you know, exponentially versus like linearly, right? Yeah. And so like that doesn't mean those are bad businesses. It just means that as a VC, I tend to look less at those kind of like brands. And I also think for brands, it's more important to think about kind of like operating with a constraint of like profitability, kind of like, you know, early on, which kind of this gets into the Stitch Fix thing. That was always a constraint that we had. And that wasn't necessarily deliberate. And Katrina's the one to tell this story, not me. But, you know, I think in the early days, famously, the company had a hard time raising money and had made the decision quite early on to kind of just optimize for profitability and predictability over growth. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why was because, you know, we were actually holding inventory. And so, you know, the model, it was actually highly risky to be like growing too fast or too slow, I guess, like, you know, buying too much inventory obviously has its implications, but actually growing too fast in terms of demand acquisition would mean that customers would just be dealing with like really long wait times. That wouldn't be a good experience for anyone. And so it was this interesting kind of dynamic where we had to build out a stronger engine around predictability early on, partially because that was the core product, was kind of this personalization engine for e-commerce, but also like around data science, around kind of just optimizing for like demand planning. Mm-hmm. It was like a muscle that the company built very early on. So we actually didn't do anything on user acquisition until pretty late in the game. Like I joined 2016 as kind of the first person in-house doing this stuff. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, partially it was because this was this novel model and we had a lot of influx of demand early on, but it was also because we ran like a really tight kind of machine on the retention piece. And this maybe ties to some of what you want to talk about on like subscriptions and kind of now having that as a service for e-com merchants who actually want to think about turning existing customers into more recurring. You know, I think there's more tools out there today than there were back then, but at Stitch Fix, this was definitely a core competency that we built out internally and part of the model. So.
Well, it's interesting because part of what you were talking about, what I heard you say was currently what you mostly invest or what you think about is channels, right? And now one of the challenges with D2C is, you know, a lot of it's focused around performance marketing. I think your investment in PostScript is a great example of a channel, right? Where channels open up, whether it's TikTok or SMS or what have you, is that's oftentimes what brands are running around after is trying to figure out, you know, what's the new channel. Or finding different channels, whether it's just a new app on the web or something like even direct mail, right? Like I haven't seen any D2C brands using direct mail, but I'm sure that someone's trying it.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's kind of like two levels of channels here. So like, I think, you know, one, you asked a question that I didn't answer, which is like, how's like D2C changed? And I do think like, I've held this point of view for some time, but I think it's now becoming more consensus that D2C is more of a channel than it is a category. And if you're a brand mm-hmm. that gets started on D2C over time, you should think about diversifying not just your marketing yeah. channels, but actually the channels through which you sell, including through other yeah. retailers, kind of wholesale, digital wholesale, that type of stuff. And then there's the marketing channels around D2C and how do you actually continue to grow your D2C business. In both of those levels, like diversification is becoming more important just because of like, we've seen what happens when you become too concentrated in any one channel, including both marketing or just kind of selling through D2C or through Amazon or whatever it might be. So I do think, and that has been a thesis behind some investments like PostScript, which is not just like, hey, this is a marketing channel, but actually like we believe that SMS is a channel by which brands are going to do commerce as well and mm-hmm. kind of view SMS as a platform. And then, you know, I've not... You know, nothing we could share, but like the pipes to actually help brands sell through other retailers and basically wholesale enablement, I think is another interesting category right now. And I would say one thing we're seeing is brands kind of considering that channel sooner than they otherwise might have. Now that you have like, you know, in the past, you used to not be able to get much analytics on who you actually sold through if you were kind of selling through like a third party. And now, you know, I think that's starting to change. So.
Got it. So just to clarify, like if you're talking about like, maybe this is not the perfect example, but if you were selling wholesale through Walmart, you might get more, and maybe Walmart's a horrible example, but like basically if you're selling wholesale, you'd be getting more analytics into the end consumer. Or is it more that if you're selling through a marketplace, something like Fair, you'd be getting more information about your end consumer?
I'm referring to both. And I don't think it's like perfect fidelity there yet. Yeah. But I think relative to 5 years ago, I think there's more of an emphasis on like brands are demanding that and building kind of the mechanisms by which you could actually like have a good kind of, I guess, like omni-channel customer view. You know, I think closing that loop is like very important to helping brands actually have a diverse set of channels. So, and I think Fair, like Fair is a business I respect immensely. Mm-hmm. You know, I know the team there well, and I think this has been part of their kind of like vision since very early on. So.
So what are you paying attention to most these days? Because I know you've also gone down into Web3, and there are some ways to tie in conversations around D2C into Web3, whether it's like the breakfast, was it the breakfast club, like the board yacht club or whatever.
Yeah.
I am curious because I think, as I recall, at least we've had some conversations like, you know, Solano is one of the like the blockchain projects that people are building on. Where's your head at these days, especially when you're thinking of commerce? Like you talked about like SMS. But then also, even since you have been this cursory interest around Web3, is that something that even right now in, we'll call it the chilly, it's not even winter yet. Who knows what season it is? No one knows.
It's winter. Yeah. There's definitely a crypto winter happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we've made some pretty significant investments around different parts of kind of crypto. Mm-hmm. For me personally, like I am interested in the intersection of kind of commerce and crypto.
Yeah.
And that's kind of manifested around investments in, you know, like NFTs and NFT infrastructure, mm-hmm. which I do think is kind of like maybe misunderstood as like oversimplified into like high priced JPEGs, mm-hmm. which there is some of that. Like, and I think that's kind of been like a, I don't know, tip of the iceberg on how kind of people could understand like kind of just some of what types of commerce NFTs enable. I'm personally less interested in, you know, when you talk about brands getting involved in this stuff, there's one angle, which is like, hey, you know, you could sell new digital SKUs alongside, like, you know, Gucci selling digital purses, you know, limited edition bags alongside your physical bags. Like, that's interesting to some people. I'm not personally as interested in kind of like that angle. What I do think is becoming more interesting is, and actually, Alex, I would put a plug in for Alex Danko at Shopify, who's doing a lot of this stuff there. He's talked a bit about kind of token gated commerce recently and about how, mm-hmm. you know, if you have like wallet aware commerce, if you mm-hmm. actually, as a brand, if you have a view into what is in a customer's wallet, meaning like crypto wallet, MetaMask, whatever it might be, Shopify native wallet, I don't know, then you actually can provide a different customer experience to that person based on what they're holding. And so that's kind of like one angle, which I think like a lot of e-commerce brands are starting to think about. There's another, which is like, and this ties into the topic here, which is like subscription, loyalty, things like mm-hmm. that. You know, I am seeing a lot of, it's starting with artists and musicians kind of using NFTs as essentially like kind of membership passes
right.
and different ways for artists to actually assess kind of like, who are your super fans and providing kind of like differentiated experiences to people based on different NFTs that they hold. And for a consumer, like it is liquid, like you could go and sell that if you're not getting the, you know, if you feel like the value is appreciated or if like, you know, you're not getting what you want out of that anymore. I do think that's like kind of another angle that brands are starting to think about, which is like, how could I both serve my super fans and kind of build like a more loyal kind of community using this? And I think that's more interesting personally than kind of like, you know, having other digital asset like SKUs live alongside my physical catalog. So
it's interesting that you bring up membership, because I think in a lot of ways, like the least interesting part around, we'll call it subscriptions, is the subscription business model. I think one thing that I've harped on and I've told you about is, like, if you were to say, like, the job to be done, most consumers don't actually care about a subscription. What they want is the product when they want it, when they need it, when it's convenient.
Yeah.
Brands want recurring revenue, largely due to the hope around, like, valuations. Obviously, there's a lot of power in compounded recurring revenue. But I think where it gets crazy is that, you know, now that we're having, like, a million brands offering subscriptions, it's like, how many $50 AOV high premium juices do you actually need delivered to your home in parallel, right? And so sort of looking at it from this perspective of, and there was like an interesting book I'd read where, I forget the author's name, but I think it was The Membership Economy, where she basically was talking about how subscriptions are a subset, are a business model within membership. And membership is the parent, right? And so thinking about, and I do think that NFTs or whatever can tie a piece into all of this, which is, I don't know necessarily where that clear delineation is. I know like there's Inveterate. You've probably heard about them at this point, where they're focusing on being a membership platform only, like membership only platform for Shopify, which is weird. Whereas with what we're doing, we actually have a membership piece. What we do is with Rodeo, there are products you can only get as a member.
Yeah.
And those products rotate versus a traditional subscription where it's like the benefit is you get 20% off and this product automatically shipped to you. I don't know. It's been thinking a lot, and I'm just curious, like, your take on around how consumer behavior, and like, this goes back to like Web3. It's like, what is it that people are valuing?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things here that one of the issues I've had with subscription, and I feel like Stitch Fix, Katrina did not like call it a subscription company, because the reality is like, you know, you could have manual, you could opt people into the cadence that, and we got more sophisticated with this over time to opt people into the cadence that we thought they wanted, because, you know, the best way to actually lose a customer is to actually send them stuff too fast so they burn out, right? Like, even if that might be that might optimize for like, you know, 1 year LTV, but probably not 5 year, which is kind of what we, you know, we wanted to like think longer term. And that was a key part of our messaging, like when we were going public and all that, you know. And I think that carries over to what a lot of Shopify brands are thinking about nowadays, which is like, it is tempting to want to opt people into subscription for categories that really might not need one. And if I think about like, you know, you want to provide customers with optionality and want that, you want to reduce friction to people getting the product when they have an intent to, but you also don't want to like kind of force feed them. And I think too much of what I've seen kind of falls into the latter camp, because it's so tempting to see that near-term revenue spike. And I think it actually is a very short-sighted approach. And so I don't like, there are some categories where I really value my subscription. So like, I'm a member of Trade Coffee. I think like there's like Seed Symbiotics, Athletic Greens, like some of that stuff where I like, I have a daily consumption habit around it. Makes sense. I don't want to have to think about ordering it. But then there's others where, you know, I give a plug for like, I don't think you would think it's a competitor, like Repeat. We're not an investor or anything, but I kind of like what they're doing, which is like, you know, just making it easier for people to kind of like reorder at the cadence that they want to. And I think you're building out some stuff like this too, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
So, you know, I think that, in my view, the right long-term play, even if it sacrifices some like near-term kind of like revenue bump. And I think, you know, merchants, brands have to think about like, really look themselves in the mirror and say like, does this actually need a subscription? And I think for a lot of categories, the answer is probably no. So
I remember like basically the business we built before Rodeo was One Click Pony, which, I mean, it was really just in time subscription, where the whole point was driving repeat purchases. But at the time, Shopify didn't have a subscription API. So we couldn't even offer the subscriptions piece. And so with Rodeo, the idea was, yeah, like how do you marry those two, where not everything should be a subscription, and force feeding people, just you're taking a loyal fan, someone who likes your product, and basically your pile up, you're making them feel taken advantage of. And when people have more and more choices, it's not a great way to run a business. I do think, and I'll tell you, from a lot of the brands that I've spoken to, a lot of them are focused on 90-day payback periods, right? Like even brands I talk to where I talk about customer centricity, right? Yeah. I think a lot of brands would say, hey, yeah, we love to be consumer centric. We care a lot about our customer. But when you start talking about, well, would you offer a flexible subscription where the customer has more control over the cadence and the interval? That's where things, you kind of start to see people, I don't want to say you start seeing behind, it's basically when you force people to make a decision. They're like, yeah, at the end of the day, I don't want someone to buy quarterly. I want to get as much as I can over the first 90 days.
Yeah.
Because of the payback period. And then the flip side there is maybe that works, or maybe that's just more of a mentality of early stage companies.
Yeah.
Because you're like, you're basically trying to get to the point of accumulating enough customers where you're like, we just need to prove the viability and grow. Whereas Stitch Fix was in a different position, but it sounds like maybe it's more philosophical, where you guys and Katrina is more like, we want to build a business really focused around like the lifetime value of a customer.
I think what's key is that you actually have enough margin so that you actually don't, you're not forcing yourself to do kind of the short-term kind of like stuff. Because the reality is if like you are, if there's existential risk to you not being able to like get positive economics in a matter of, you know, months, like that can be problematic. And, you know, you run the risk of like sucking up a bunch of venture funding to get something that's really never going to get to like a real business. And so there's like first order profitability. There's different ways of looking at this, but you know, at Stitch Fix, we basically knew for us, the key variable was keep rate. If we sent someone 5 items, like there is, you know, a number at which they need to keep for that order to be profitable. Mm-hmm. And we built a bunch of I mean, that was our core product, was a styling algorithm to actually make sure that people were happier with what they got. And, you know, it was keep rate was really the main metric we were trying to optimize. And, you know, if you have a keep rate of call it 1 on like multiple orders, like that's not going to close the gap, you know? So that was kind of the nuance of like our business. The other point on like kind of that you were making around, you know, I guess like delightful like end experiences to consumers, like it made me think of, yeah, I mentioned Trade Coffee, but there's actually like, I'm friends with the team at Fellow Coffee, and they actually, you know, they make great kind of coffee gear, which you wouldn't need to subscribe to. You should own this stuff. But I think like as a subscription, they've kind of now built an experience where they you know, they source like different high-end beans and different than Trade, where like you get a new roaster like every week. With them, I will get a text from them. And obviously I'm a big fan of SMS, but like I'll get it. They have my, you know, my credit card kind of stored, and I could just respond with, if I went 1, 2, 3, 4, or not respond at all, I won't get any bags. But whenever I get a text from them, basically like a semi-subscription where I'm subscribed to the text, but I don't have to buy anything. And then I think they built that experience natively, but that's cool. And that's like some of the stuff we used to talk about at Pony. So
that's awesome. Yeah, no, I think it's that middle ground where, and especially it's ultimately, it's like, how do you make a great experience for a customer? And like what you just said, it's about feeling in control. And obviously also you like their product, but not feeling like you have to do a whole lot of work. And I would imagine a lot of it too is around communication, where you know that they're going to communicate with you ahead of anything. And also their business model is such that if you don't reply, nothing happens. They don't charge you. Which leads me to like, like, are there any other sort of brand experiences that you've had recently that positively or negatively you're like, holy crap, this is something to remember?
Honestly, that was the main one that came into mind, but it could be because I just really like coffee. I was tempted to give an example on like the Sonos, like kind of the upgrade program, just because it was like, oh, that was effective on me. But then they like went back and lost my trust because like of everything's backordered there, which I know is not entirely their fault. But as far as like new kind of emerging brands, honestly, like, you know, the coffee ones were the ones that kind of came to mind. And I think the Trade one's pretty cool, but it's, I also like that as a channel. I'd be curious what you're seeing too, and what answers you're hearing here that are interesting. But
yeah, I mean, Trade is one of the better ones. And I've actually spoken like their head of product. I spoke to a bunch of the people who worked there in Parks. I was just really appreciated the thoughtfulness that went into the design of their experience. And then like, what were some of the things they would have done differently? Because they also built their own platform. They didn't use Shopify. They didn't use anything. And, you know, in terms of brand experiences that I've had recently that are great, and actually, I think most of the ones that stand out to me are the bad ones. I think for a while I had a subscription plan to Food where they would do my macros. This is like when I was getting ready to get married. They basically would, I would weigh myself once a week, and they would use Grubhub's API to send me food that would basically match the macros to eventually reduce my weight to the point of what my goal weight was. And every week I would do a weigh-in, and based off of my progress, they would adjust the meals. Because one of the unique things about franchises, if you're on like Grubhub or something, is you have access to calorie information on meals. And I think they had some of their own like machine learning, or we'll call it AI. I don't know. They basically probably had a bunch of if statements that tried to basically identify what foods were most likely like without a lot of sauces, so they could estimate portions and like calories. That was a magical experience. The customer experience became too much, where they would send me food, but I had to give them like 48 or 72 hours notice if I didn't want them to send me a meal. And because I would like travel or have like a meeting or invite my wife out for dinner, what ended up happening is it was a really bad experience because I was wasting like half of the food. So that, similar to what you talked about, it was like what started off as a great experience turned into a really disappointing one.
Back in the day, I used to do like the X of the month club, like beer, wine, you know, whatever. I've only been gifted this, but like Table 22, I think, was doing some interesting stuff where basically helping restaurants kind of like launch new SKUs, and I could subscribe to like, you know, certain restaurants. That felt interesting and like unique as kind of like ancillary revenue line to kind of restaurants where I have like some brand loyalty and getting to like take some of that stuff home. I also think, I mean, Gold Belly is not really, it's not a subscription thing, so it's probably not relevant, but I also think that's like in that vein. I think you could do a lot of interesting stuff with like food and kind of like tapping into something where I have some loyalty, but don't have like great access or like regular access to that at home. So I think there's potential in those models, but I'm not sure about kind of durable, kind of like regular subscription there. So,
yeah, well, I think that there's just a lot of room for experimentation, and I'm excited to see. I know a lot of this is both enabled by like creativity of the brands as well as the tools and the people are building. Hey, I know you have a hard stop. So before we end, one thing I always like to ask is, like, do you have a big ask that you could put out into the world? Like, is there one thing that would change your life personally or professionally that if it were to happen would be like a huge, huge transformation for you?
Oh, geez.
Maybe it's a biz dev deal, but I don't know.
No, I mean, yeah, the real answer is
that doesn't have to be.
Yeah. I have two kids at home. I need more sleep. That aside, no, I mean, I think like in my job, I love what I get to do, which is like learn from founders and kind of just, you know, try to be at the forefront of like interesting things that are happening. And so the reality is like the favor for anyone listening is like, if you are building or have come across kind of like any experiences that kind of are shining some light into what the future of e-commerce could look like I would love to meet with those people. And so that's the shameless plug, but that's all I got for you. So.
Yeah. Well, hey, I mean, that's good enough. And if people, I don't know if you're much of a Twitterer, I don't think I've really seen you do that many tweets. Like, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you or follow what you're doing?
Yeah. MDubo on Twitter. I'm not super active. And then just, you know, Mike at Greylock. So yeah, either of those work. Yeah.
Cool. But you don't have a podcast.
No, I do some stuff on our Greylock platform on Grey Matter. We've done some podcasts there, but yeah, MDubo at Twitter is the best way to get in touch. You just DM me there. So. Yeah.
Well, awesome, man. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Always great chatting, Ben. See ya.
Take care.
Bye.